When the wheels come off NASCAR.
Crash on the track.
Oh, heavy contact, cars crashing. Oh. One car in flames. Look at the front of that car, completely destroyed.
Oh, my goodness.
Crashes are crowd pleasers for some NASCAR fans, but what happens when it's the car companies who wreck, off the track? NASCAR in the era of bankrupt GM and Chrysler. It's a 9 million car pileup. Who walks away from that? No one on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, June 8th. It changes NASCAR when two of the four manufacturers are actually bankrupt going around the track there. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, it's the beginning of the week, which means it's time for the Takeaway agenda, all the big stories to come later on this week. Also, how the road to a stable Pakistan may lead through the classroom. All this and more ahead. But first, the morning's top headlines. And in the headlines, Hezbollah has lost to a U.S.-backed coalition in Lebanon. Final results are just in this morning from yesterday's vote. Analysts had predicted Hezbollah and its allies would win the race. The pro-Western coalition won one additional seat in the contest. Turnout was higher than the last vote in 2005. Full analysis a bit later this hour when we go to Beirut and our BBC partners. North Korea's highest court says two American journalists must do 12 years of hard labor. Pyongyang's top court convicted Laura Ling and Una Lee of illegal entry and sentenced them today. They were arrested in March near the China-North Korea border. New signs of a coming missile test. Japan says Pyongyang is telling ships to stay away from its coast. This is a typical move ahead of a missile trial. Over the weekend, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. is considering putting North Korea back on the list of states that sponsor terrorism.
You know, we take it very seriously. I mean, obviously, they were taken off of the list for a purpose, and that purpose is being thwarted by their action.
It was the Bush administration who took North Korea off the terror list. Femi Oke, what else is new this morning?
Hello there. President Obama is back on American soil and focusing on domestic issues. Today, he'll meet with his cabinet to talk about stimulus spending. This week also kicks off a renewed White House push on changing health care. Searchers are now certain that they've located the wreckage of the Air France Rio to Paris flight. Crews recovered more than a dozen bodies and debris confirmed to be from the plane over the weekend. The search continues for the plane's flight recorders, and there's a high-tech international team helping to look, and the US Navy team is on its way to help. New violence in Gaza. Israeli troops killed four Palestinian gunmen trying to cross into Israel. The Palestinians fired back, but there are no reports of Israeli casualties. Gaza has been relatively quiet since Israel's January offensive against Hamas, but there's still occasional violence along the border. Billy Elliot is the Tony Award winner for Broadway's Best Musical. It took home 10 awards altogether. God of Carnage won for Best Play. John.
The L.A. Lakers have a 2-0 lead over the Orlando Magic. Looks like the Lakers are going to stomp. Asian stock markets were a mix of positive and negative closings this morning. The S&P starts trading at 9:40. Futures suggest a negative opening when Wall Street opens in about an hour and a half from now. We're talking all day about how you decide what it is that you eat. Is it just about stopping hunger? Or do you make decisions based on morality, economics, medicine? What fuels the decisions on what you put on your plate? There's a story there. Tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. Well, it's Monday. I'm John Hockenberry, and let's get your week off to a good start.
Our government.
Bailout.
Your government.
Energy resources.
Healthcare.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Global financial recession.
The work that needs to be done.
What's the agenda this week? Well, joining us is Marcus Mabry, international business editor for the New York Times, in studio. And there's a lot, actually, to take a look at in stories that are happening this week. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning, John.
It's another Monday, and the headline is North Korea. The headline is specifically North Korea sentencing two U.S. reporters who've been in custody since March to 12 years in forced labor. presenting another challenge to the Obama administration. This isn't the first time we've talked about this test of the Obama administration. How do you figure this development either escalates or prolongs what seems to be brewing into an international crisis?
Well, it'll be interesting to see this week, of course, what exactly the administration comes back with. We had Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talking over the weekend about the possibility of putting North Korea back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism. We have a report by David Sanger in the Times talking about the administration considering, actually perhaps with the help of the Chinese, a plan to perhaps intercept North Korean ships that have to do with nuclear technology or transporting nuclear know-how. So on many different fronts, we have the administration confronted by this kind of, to use the former president's phrase, rogue nation. And this kind of really has risen to the top of the rogue nation list now, and they're trying to figure out what options they'll have. But this week, I expect we'll see how hard a line will the administration toe on this, and will those two American journalists really be used as pawns in North Korea's kind of, you know, something to trade?
Well, it seems as though the answer to that question is probably yes, they'll be used as pawns. But with all the sort of inflammatory language regarding North Korea, rogue nation, sponsor of terrorism, it's surprising to me the kind of tone that people take in talking about this sentencing. Listen to this.
I'm actually not surprised that they were sentenced. My feeling was that they would be sentenced to kind of send a message to probably other journalists. And the 12 years is difficult to hear, but I'm hoping that it's more symbolic than anything else and that maybe they'll be released within a matter of months.
That's a friend and former colleague of those journalists, Holly Gibson, talking about, you know, 12-year sentence. She's not alarmed exactly. It's as though this is a chess game. These people are caught in the middle of it. But is that a valid assumption? I mean, it's possible that it's maybe not a chess game and that they're going to stay there for 12 years.
Well, you're right. I mean, this is the danger. It's hard to imagine that, and it may be hard to imagine that even, especially if you're friends of the journalist, but as any foreign correspondent or someone who has been in like situations, it's hard to imagine that kind of long purgatory sentence. It's been a long time since we've seen American journalists withstand that, probably since Terry Anderson, you know, decades ago. It's hard for us to imagine that. And that's one point. But on the second point, I think we can't know. This is North Korea. This is the problem. This is the problem of the Hermit Kingdom. It is hard to have an adversary, as the U.S. has now for a long time with North Korea, which is inscrutable, which you have no idea if they're even playing by the kind of rules of rational realpolitik. And that has really been the problem all along with North Korea. And as we face a nuclear situation with them and perhaps even a succession battle over there right now, we don't know.
Which they're in the middle of.
These are really, really scary questions that no one can actually fathom or answer.
All right. It also appears that this week, at some point, this very familiar voice from the post-9/11 era is going to be back in the news.
The United States government is going to have to first discover what does the pot consist of, and then decide whether to simply distribute the money to victims based on a percentage of what they invested through Madoff, or will there be an attempt to prioritize the claim?
There's the deliberative, rational thinking of Ken Feinberg, who was, of course, the special master after 9/11, who determined the compensation for individual victims of the 9/11 disaster. There he's talking about the Madoff controversy. It appears as though he's going to be named something called a pay czar in the federal government. First of all, what would this person do? Is Ken Feinberg the guy for the job? And what precedent is there for a job like this?
Well, you know, those are all excellent questions. It's ironic that we're now going to have this. It's going to be special master for compensation. It'll probably be the likely title. Will definitely be announced this week. It's going to be a huge story this week. This is the latest in an ongoing tug of war between the administration and the financial sector. Having been rescued by taxpayer dollars, Wall Street, the biggest financial firms in our country, are now trying to get the government off their back. And so this week we're going to see this kind of tug of war take the place of they're going to try to get out. The government will announce this week which banks will be able to get out from under the TARP regulations, will be allowed to repay their TARP money, the Troubled Asset Relief Program that they got billions from.
Right.
And then by the end of the month, be done with that. And the Wall Street firms, the biggest firms, would certainly love to think that after that, they're done with Washington and Washington will be out of their business. But the administration is going to come back with the announcement of Mr. Feinberg as the pay czar. And what's going to be interesting to see is who will be under his regulation.
Right.
Number one, once you repay that money, it is not clear that the administration really has a great deal of leeway to make you do whatever it wants as far as pay. And so far, all we've seen all we've seen so far, as far as compensation rules, sure, from Washington, from Congress, has been a rule that if you receive TARP money, your top 25 executives, none of them can earn a bonus, an oversized bonus that's more than one-third of their base salary. That's it. Well, what has
Wall
Street done?
That's the only rule.
What has Wall Street done? Wall Street has hiked everyone's base
salary. There you go.
Obviously. So it's going to be interesting to see how in the world the administration gets around, you know, if you repay the TARP money, we're still going to tell you what you can compensate your top 25 earners in your firm. It's going to be interesting to see how those rules are promulgated when they come out this week, and that's going to be a huge story to watch as far as what happens in the financial sector.
Given the success of the Apple Corporation under Steve Jobs, is there any compensation number that is too high if he comes back? He's now a pancreatic cancer survivor. It looks like Steve Jobs will be back this week, and the stock market will be reacting to that.
Well, it's really interesting. Apple's annual developer conference is happening starting today, and the question is going to be, Apple has not said, they have said Steve Jobs will be back on the job by the end of the month. They have not said, however, he's going to actually be at this conference. The irony is, if he's not at the conference, given the kind of rumors out there in the blogosphere, then Apple may pay a price, even though they never expected him to be there. The rumor mill has generated this expectation. So if he's not there, then I think the kind of geekerati is going to be incredibly disappointed.
The geekerati?
And it'll be interesting to see if...
You heard it first here on the agenda with Marcus Mabry of the New York Times. So let's go to foreign affairs again. Lebanon, an election. It appears that Hezbollah and Iran have been repudiated by voters in Lebanon. What's the significance of that?
It's usually significant because that was not the expectation. The expectation was for a close race, but one in which Hezbollah would actually come out with its allies on top. And in fact, you have the American allied and backed coalition coming out on top. And that's incredible news. It's incredibly good news for this administration coming right after President Obama's speech last week in Cairo, in which he offered a new hand of peace in the Middle East and offered a new conception of American and especially Arab-Islamic relations. There's already talk of an Obama effect. I don't know if that's going to be overblown. We'll see this week whether, when the analysis comes back of who voted and how they actually won, we'll get a sense of whether or not there is such a thing as an Obama effect, or whether or not this was a coincidence whereby the people of Lebanon decided they weren't going to go with Hezbollah.
Well, on Wednesday, a test of the so-called Obama effect will be in the details of Benjamin Netanyahu's speech, a wide-ranging speech that he's billed to talk about his plan for approaching the roadmap and the whole question of Arab-Israeli peace. Of course, the administration is against settlements. Supposedly, Israel has sort of signed up for that, but it's unclear. Is Netanyahu likely to take a hard line here or be conciliatory?
Well, it's in Netanyahu's history, and he's a politician with a long history in Israel, and actually was once the spokesman here in the U.S. way back in the 80s, so we've been familiar with him for decades. He's rarely been a guy who's been conciliatory. He's basically been a hardliner, someone with a very distinct hardcore ideology. It could be a Nixon goes to China moment. He could certainly kind of surprise the opposition in Israel and is opposed to the
U.S. Well, let me back
you
up there. If it is a Nixon goes to China moment, if Netanyahu does something surprising, is that part of the Obama effect, do you think?
Well, that's interesting. You know, I'm sure supporters of the president will probably say it is, but I think, again, you're dealing with the Middle East. You're talking about so many complexities and kind of three-layer chess here.
All politics is local in Israel.
Exactly.
There you go.
It's hard to imagine that, you know, he gets all the credit for it.
Finally, the Obama administration has had a difficulty, it seems to me, getting the message in an entire week on the domestic agenda. They've done well on foreign affairs, but had more difficulty on the domestic side. Healthcare is supposedly the issue this week. What do we look for the administration really trying to get a sustained effort there?
Well, you know, they've had this stealth battle going on. It's going to be, and they've kind of had letting their supporters know by through tweeters, through constant email contacts, that they have this big plan coming, this fight coming. The fight really is already being waged in Washington. It'll be interesting to see what publicly they let come out this week.
And the details of the plan will certainly determine how the debate is going to go on Capitol Hill. Marcus Mabry, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partners, the New York Times. It would be an overstatement to say he's one of the geekerati. That's your agenda this week on The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. So what's on your dinner plate? There's a story behind what's on your plate, not only how it got there, but why you chose to put it there. In fact, every item on your menu could be a morality play.
20 years ago, I lived on the east end of Long Island and saw migrant farmers living on the potato fields and started buying organic foods because I felt it wasn't fair for them to be living with all those chemicals and watching those little kids, their children, run around.
The morality of what you eat for breakfast, lunch, or dinner. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Tell us your story, or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So here's President Obama speaking last week in Cairo. You decide. Is this nuts and bolts politics, or maybe a little bit of symbolism?
It was Islam at places like Uluzan that carried the light of learning through so many centuries, paving the way for Europe's renaissance and enlightenment.
President Obama, it's fair to say, is looking for a new enlightenment in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. But traditionally, Islamic schools, so-called madrasas, have not been seen by U.S. policymakers as a force for curbing extremism. In fact, just the opposite. So what educational policy in the Muslim world could have an impact? It's a question that got our friend Christine Fair of the RAND Corporation thinking. She co-wrote an article about madrasas, the schools in Pakistan that are famous for producing terrorists, to assist in the development of a nation like Pakistan. Christine Fair joins us from Alexandria, Virginia. Good morning, Christine.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Now, we've heard all sorts of things about madrasas, the schools that so-called indoctrinate people as weapons of mass instruction, give them a view of the Quran, but little else. But in your article, you suggest that, in fact, madrasas are an infrastructure that represent a possible opportunity for the Obama administration. Explain.
Well, actually, the article doesn't exactly make that argument. I mean, we basically find in our data that there is this misconception that madrasas are one of the most possible educational opportunities for poor children. We don't find that at all. We actually find that madrasa attendance accounts for something at most 1 to 3% of all students that are enrolled full-time in Pakistan. So this idea that Pakistan is chock full of madrasas and that madrasas are the school of last resort, we just find to be false. We actually argue that the most interesting educational opportunity in Pakistan for the United States and the international donor community to have an influence is actually private schools. Private schools are usually thought of as being elite here in the United States, but in Pakistan, private schools are actually more cost-effective than public schools. We find that the madrasa infrastructure is just too difficult to influence. So even though a small number of madrasas are likely producing terrorism, we argue that that's really a law enforcement and intelligence problem, not a driver of educational policy. And so we basically come down in our article to suggesting that the Ministry of Education is too difficult to influence, madrasas are impossible to influence, and therefore where the U.S. and the international donor community should invest its resources is really Pakistan's private schools.
All right, Christine, listen to this, one of the few really straightforward programmatic statements that the president made in Cairo last week, and let's see if it relates to what you're talking about in your article. Hold on.
We also know that military power alone is not going to solve the problems in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's why we plan to invest $1.5 billion each year over the next 5 years to partner with Pakistanis to build schools and hospitals, roads and businesses, and hundreds of millions to help those who've been displaced.
$1.5 billion. Do you suggest that that money should go not to alternatives to madrasas, because as you say, they're a small infrastructure in Pakistan, but to these private schools and to bolster their educational value inside Pakistan?
Well, unfortunately, my experience has been talking to folks in the U.S. government is that it's very difficult for them to deal with the private sector. And part of it is the requirement to deal with the federal government of Pakistan. And this is a huge opportunity lost. I mean, as it is the $100 million, which is not an enormous sum, that the United States already gave to Pakistan for educational reform was, quote, can't be found by an aid official that was speaking on this issue. So the problem with Pakistan is not that there's not enough schools per se. In fact, you've got many schools in Pakistan that are called ghost schools, schools that exist on paper. And in fact, there is a building there. But because of the corruption, basically you have people drawing salaries as teachers when in fact there's no teaching going on. So part of the problem with education in Pakistan is, like every other public sector, is absolutely riven with corruption. So we're arguing that the United States and the other donors needs to be a little bit more creative than they've been in the past. If you actually want to deliver a benefit, you're probably not going to get there through dealing with the public educational system, but rather these private schools, which are much more responsive to parental preferences. They can link compensation to quality performance. And most importantly, they can fire teachers who don't show up. And as a consequence, teachers are more likely to show up in private schools than they are in public schools.
So is the takeaway here focus not so much on madrasas because they're not as significant as the sort of mythology would lead us to believe? Corruption is a bigger danger, a bigger threat to education in Pakistan than even Islam, and to try to find a more creative way of spending money in the educational sector.
I think that's the bottom line. Now, we don't want to give the illusion that all madrasas are innocent, but we also want to say very clearly that they are a very small number. And of that small number, a smaller number yet are actually involved in the production of terrorism. And that, of course, is a law enforcement challenge, not a driver of educational policy.
Well, you can read the details in this month's Foreign Policy. Christine Fair co-wrote the article. She's an expert at the RAND Corporation, talking about madrasas and their over-significance in U.S. foreign policy, potentially. Christine, thanks so much for being with us. And Femi Okeh has our headlines now.
Thanks, John. It's almost 28 minutes past the hour. The U.S. is sending help in its efforts to recover debris from the Air France jet that crashed off the coast of Brazil last week. A Navy team leaves today with devices that can detect emergency beacons like the flight's black box records 20,000 feet below the surface. Yesterday, rescuers pulled more than a dozen bodies from the crash site. In Lebanon, it's confirmed the U.S.-backed coalition has won the majority of seats in the parliamentary election over the alliance headed by Hezbollah. Saad Hariri's coalition party took a majority of the parliamentary seats. And in U.S. politics, the president is back in Washington after a trip to the Middle East and Europe. President Obama meets with his cabinet today to talk specifics on summer stimulus spending in an effort to curb rising unemployment. This morning, the president released details on a plan to create more than 600,000 new jobs. He will use stimulus money to add maintenance workers to military bases, make improvements to roads and airports, and help states budget for education jobs. The Obama administration is also expected to announce a new set of executive compensation regulations this week, and the plan would require corporations that receive two rounds of bailout money to get approval from a new pay czar for any executive pay changes. Let's look at top stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. So here's a question. How do you decide what you eat? You go over to the cupboard and whatever's there, you eat it. Well, no. Most people's decisions about food are way more than just stopping hunger. There are morality elements, environmental elements. What's the story about how you feed yourself?
Hi, my name is Jack from Newark. I'm on a vegan whole grain diet for health reasons. I'm not concerned about animals. I'm not an animal lover. strictly for health. Thank you.
Why do you eat what you eat? What's the dimension and what's the story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org? So it seems as though every week for the last 10 weeks on this show, at least, we've had headlines about the auto industries driving themselves towards bankruptcy. Well, now two of the auto companies, GM and Chrysler, are bankrupt. And so it occurs to us, what does it mean for the mystique, the mythology, the kind of sort of magic of the car companies?
Some people say that NASCAR isn't a real sport. And yet this is a place where real men strap in an 800-horsepower beast for 4 hours in 110-degree temperatures at 200 miles an hour. Where families and rivalries, patriotism and history all come together in a bumper-to-bumper, shoulder-to-shoulder, coast-to-coast blaze of glory. What's more real than that?
Indeed, if you do the numbers, it may just be the case that NASCAR, the sport of NASCAR, is more valuable than at least two of the bankrupt car companies, General Motors and Chrysler. What does it mean for NASCAR as it kicks off its season this year? Gary Belsky, editor-in-chief of ESPN Magazine, is in the studio with us. What does it mean when the wrecks take place financially off the track for NASCAR?
Well, I think it means that nice to see you, by the way.
Yeah, great to be here.
I think it means that NASCAR is even more anxious than they have been anyway over the past couple of years because of economic pressures on the circuit, on the sport in general. Attendance is down, ratings are down. There's a whole bunch of reasons for that, but the bankruptcy doesn't help, and in fact, it hurts. But last year, if you remember, GM actually did some serious cost cutting in terms of its NASCAR sponsorship, and the sport survive that. I don't expect right now that there's going to be any major announcements about NASCAR, about GM cutting more money to auto racing, at least at the moment.
Isn't there a sort of a myth about NASCAR that the cars that you see running around the track even remotely resemble the cars you can buy at a dealership? I mean, NASCAR, its origin was
stock car racing.
Stock
That's
car
what
racing.
It stands for.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, it is a myth. Right now, most of it is stickers. In fact, what I mean by that is that the cars of tomorrow, literally, that's the official term of art for the NASCAR automobile that they all race, are basically this a hybrid special kind of car that's manufactured specifically for the teams, and it bears very little resemblance to the cars that you and I drive every day, or sometimes, given that we live in New York. And the most significant thing, by the way, is that aside from the shape being different, and that's what I meant by stickers, they actually put stickers on the car to make it look like they're the same automobile. The engines are very different. Because they were worried about cheating with computers, there are no computers anymore on NASCAR cars. They're literally like the cars of the 60s now. They are old-fashioned. They're high-performance engines, but they are basic engines that are worked on extensively by these very sophisticated crews, but no computers.
And the technology is not available to you in your own garage here.
Well, it is if you buy a 1965 Chevy Camaro, I guess, but meaning the cars themselves are sort of throwbacks, but the technology to make them operate as efficiently as they need to race a NASCAR is not available. In fact, that's where a lot of the exchange of information goes these days. The automotive industry gets a lot of information from NASCAR in terms of testing and how to figure out how to make aerodynamics better on the cars that you and I buy.
So it's the technology coming from NASCAR that goes to the car companies rather than the other way around.
In many ways, yes, that's the case too.
How does a bankrupt Chrysler and GM affect this overall mystique about the auto, our love affair with the automobile, and how does that then affect NASCAR?
Well, what's interesting, in terms of our love affair with automobiles, I mean, I think in general, our love affair with automobiles for many people in this country has extended overseas, right? A lot of people love German cars or they love Japanese cars. I think there's an old saying in NASCAR that a lot of people who aren't fans of stock car racing don't know, which is win on Sunday, sell on Monday, right? And that's still very much the case, which is GM and Chrysler, they fundamentally believe that if their cars win consistently in auto racing, that there's a measurable connection to dealership sales. And I think that's still probably the case. People, in fact, are very much, if you talk to our NASCAR senior writers, they'll tell you that people are often not necessarily as committed to a driver, a Dale Earnhardt or a Tony Stewart or a Jeff Gordon, as much as they are to a make of car. They want Chevy to win.
But in this particular case, does the Chevy logo on the car, is it anything really different from the Viagra logo on the car, in that both are just sponsors. It's a Chevy car, but really, it's just an advertising sticker.
I think there is a difference. First of all, remember, when you go to a track and NASCAR sponsors the track, they sponsor a lot of cars, they sponsor a lot of teams, obviously. GM sponsors tracks and sponsors teams. When you go to a track, there's often a showroom. There's not a Viagra showroom. God knows what that would look like, by the
oh
way.
My God.
There's not, but there, but there, oh, but there usually is a Chevy day. Showroom for sure. There's a, the manufacturers get showrooms at different tracks that they sponsor. So there is much more of a causal connection with a sponsor that's an automobile sponsor or a spark plug sponsor, whatever it might be.
But it's still way more about sales than it is about technology, engineering, and the idea that if you're in that Chevy, you're somehow related to the race car that won on Sunday.
Yeah, but I don't think you want to underestimate the power of myth in consumer America, right? And I think the fact that a Chevy wins makes a difference to people who are thinking about buying cars, people who pay attention to the sport of stock car racing anyway.
Gary Belsky, thanks so much for talking about the reaction of NASCAR to the bankruptcy of Chrysler and General Motors, and also for the thought of a Viagra showroom and what they look like. Gary Belsky, of course, is our friend and editor-in-chief of ESPN Magazine. And now Femi Okeh has our headlines.
At 22 minutes to the top of the hour, five American contractors have been detained in Baghdad in connection with the killing of another American contractor. The U.S. Embassy says that the contractors haven't been formally charged, but under Iraqi law, charges aren't made until a court appearance. If the case goes to court, the five men will be the first Americans tried under Iraqi law.
It's a real test of the Iraqi judiciary.
It is,
indeed.
It's
a really important story.
Be following this one very carefully indeed. Also in Baghdad, a bomb tore through a minibus during morning rush hour today, killing at least 9 people and wounding 24. The blast struck a Shiite enclave in a mainly Sunni neighborhood. And as the U.S. draws down troops in Iraq, some 7,000 new U.S. troops are fanning out across Afghanistan. The Marines are the first wave of 21,000 troops ordered to Afghanistan this summer. This morning, North Korea has sentenced two American reporters to 12 years of hard labor. Holly Gibson used to work with Laura Ling and Una Lee and says the conviction is a warning.
This is a pretty clear message to other journalists to say, if you are caught, this is what's going to happen. We're not kidding. We definitely do not want people doing stories on what the situation may be over there.
The two women were convicted of, and I'm going to quote here, committing hostilities against the Korean nation and illegal entry, end of quote. They were detained along the North Korean border with China in March while working on a story about refugees. That's a look at some of the top stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Another look now at a story we talked about in the agenda segment earlier on in the hour. Louise Story joins us, a reporter for The New York Times, to talk about the Obama administration saying this week they are poised to announce a new set of regulations on executive compensation that would include an executive pay czar who will actually determine the compensation of banks and financial institutions receiving money from the so-called TARP, the bailout fund that is keeping those institutions afloat. Louise, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What is the precedent for a single individual determining executive pay compensation, and is there any sort of law that this individual would be relying on?
There is no precedent that I know of. Typically, when there's rules about income that people get, it goes through taxation, and taxes do not usually apply to a single industry. They're generally across income levels, across all industries.
So the idea is that this executive czar, and there is a very prominent candidate for this, is going to actually be putting down on paper the numbers for executives at Citicorp and Bank of America. As was the case under the 9/11 compensation fund, where a so-called special master determined the victim's compensation, is this a sort of a shoot from the hip proposition?
Well, Ken Feinberg, who is in line to do this job, he's the one who was the 9/11 compensation czar, certainly has a very measured approach. He did stir a lot of controversy back after September 11th because he paid more money out to the families of victims who made more money. So, for example, he paid more money to the family of a stock trader than he did to the family of a janitor. So that was controversial back then. He is happy to take controversial stances, but he has a very measured approach if we look at what happened back then.
Do you think, and again, I don't want to ask you to speculate necessarily, you're a reporter for the Times, not necessarily an analyst here, but this looks to me like an effort to get the political heat off of the White House on this whole executive compensation business and off the Treasury and onto one individual. What do you think?
Certainly, a lot of people have been waiting to see some form of action coming out about compensation. It's been a heated topic since early in the year, and so this is much awaited. It's unclear that the whole role will be played by this czar because most of his power is over companies that have gotten bailed out twice, and the administration is also stepping towards making guidelines about pay for all of finance, even hedge funds and private equity, and those guidelines would probably be enforced by regulators, not by the compensation czar.
So it's possible that this compensation czar will be creating the template for a broader regulation of the entire financial system.
He may be involved. It's unclear where the template's going to come from. The general principles behind the template are coming out of Treasury as early as this week, and then they'll be fleshed out, and those are likely to be handled by regulators because they will be permanent, whereas the compensation czar's role will only last a few years while companies have the bailout money.
Well, I can't tell, looking at the story here, if this is a job that anyone would actually want or if it's a job that you would actually enthusiastically, you know, embrace because you're, at least theoretically, really, really powerful. But it is, as you say, an unprecedented development, and we shall see how much the bankers get as a result of this compensation czar. Louise Story, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Louise Story is a reporter for the New York Times reporting on the compensation czar that will allegedly be named by the administration this week.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Is there a story behind the food on your plate?
I'm a vegetarian because I think it's the healthiest way to go. I also am an animal rights advocate. I believe animals shouldn't be exploited, especially for luxury items like big steaks, etc.
The medicinal and moral dimensions of food on The Takeaway. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your story or mytake@thetakeaway.org. More on the Lebanese election in a moment, but first, Femi Okeh has our headlines.
At almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. A U.S. Navy team is on the way to join the search team for the Air France Rio to Brazil flight. The team has special underwater listening tools designed to locate the signals from the downed plane's flight recorders. Now, over the weekend, crews narrowed their search area after they found bodies and wreckage confirmed to be from the plane. Commander Christophe Prazouk of the French military has the latest on the search.
So far, 17 bodies have been found and they are on board one of the ships. So we are still working with the aircraft trying to find debris on the sea surface.
There's an international search team on site using planes, boats and submarines to look. President Obama is back on American soil and focusing on domestic issues. Today he'll meet with his cabinet to talk about the continued rollout of stimulus money. This week also kicks off a renewed White House push on changing healthcare. In sports, the LA Lakers now have a 2-0 lead over the Orlando Magic in the NBA Finals. Lakers coach Phil Jackson said the team had to step up because Kobe Bryant had a bad night.
I didn't think Kobe had a good game at all as far as his standards go. They double-teamed him, they trapped him, they came on all his drives, and, we didn't adjust to it immediately.
The next game is tomorrow night.
Orlando's going to have to find some magic.
And finally, in the weekend box office, Walt Disney's 3D feature Up topped the movie charts for a second weekend in a row.
Hi, Mr. Frederickson. Please let me in.
No. All right.
Disney Pixar's Up.
So that would be the trailer of the movie you just mentioned.
Did you recognize Mr. Frederickson? Do you know who it is?
Is that Ed Asner?
It is.
From the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
He loves Spunk. I told you that earlier. $44 million it poured in this weekend.
Wow, that's huge.
John.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So we go now to Beirut, where the election results have just become official this morning. Haytham Nasr joins us. He's a 28-year-old from Beirut. Haytham, good morning.
Good morning.
This was your first election that you voted in?
Yes, it is. It is.
And can you tell us how you voted?
Well, basically, you know, went down in the morning. Polling stations were set up in different districts within Beirut and Lebanon. And I went down quite early and, you know, casted my vote. It was all very calm, very well organized. It was actually a very, very impressive kind of elections.
And who did you vote for, if I may ask?
I voted for March 14th. In specific, I was voting in Beirut, so I voted for Saad Hariri and his list.
Well, Haytham Nasr backed a winner when he voted this morning. The March 14th block, named after the date of a huge rally against Syria's military presence in 2005, won unexpectedly the balloting in Beirut, Lebanon. Also joining us is Amal Saad Ghoreb. She's an expert on Hezbollah and author of the book Hezbollah, Politics and Religion. Amal, this was really a setback for Hezbollah, which has seen political gains really going back decades in Lebanon. How would you gauge the significance of this victory of the March 14th coalition?
Well, I wouldn't call it a major setback, because Hezbollah and its allies did not enjoy a majority before this election. They were where they were the political minority then, as they are now. And in fact, the win that March 14 now has is practically the same as it was in 2005. However, I would say that the election result came as a very big surprise, not only to the opposition and Hezbollah in it, but to many international observers as well as opinion pollsters, all of whom had predicted a slim win by the opposition.
Peace in Lebanon has often depended upon a very precarious balance between the political forces, be they religious, be they so-called tribal. Would you say that this election represents a vote for equilibrium in Lebanon?
I don't really understand your point for equilibrium. In what sense?
Well, in the sense that have we achieved, does this election result mean that people have voted for a restoration of the balance between the political forces, and that stability and peace is much more interesting than the political programs of the individual groups?
Not really, because the country remains as polarized as ever. The March 14 camp, which is called in the Western media the Western backed coalition, is in power again, and the opposition is out of power again. They support Hezbollah's right to retain its arms. They support resistance. They want Lebanon to remain out of the U.S. Orbit and so on. So these strategic issues remain sticking points, and on the contrary, I foresee a period now of instability and crisis if the winning camp does not allow the opposition to have a veto-wielding third of seats in the cabinet.
Well,
so I wouldn't say it's a vote for equilibrium, no.
All right, well, let's talk about the veto idea. The Constitution, when the government sort of reassembled itself and this election campaign began, gave Hezbollah a veto in the coalition. Is it possible they're going to re-examine that now as a result of this polling?
Yes, it is, because before these elections were held, the March 14 camp, the Western Back Coalition, were threatening that they would not accept an opposition veto-wielding third this time round, although that was the case last year. Last year, after the May 7 clashes, the Doha Accord was brokered, which led to an agreement whereby the opposition could enjoy a veto-wielding third. This time round, before the elections, March 14 has said they will not grant the other side a veto-wielding third, although the opposition had said if it would win, it would grant March 14 such veto power. So that's where the real problem lies today, if March 14 remains intransigent on this issue.
Well, Amal Saad Goreyev, of course, describing the debate that's now going to begin with the election results as of today. Haytham Nasser, you voted for the March 14th coalition. Do you think this question of a veto and the suggestion that, in fact, there's going to be a period of crisis now, is that something that you're feeling this morning?
I actually have to disagree with Amal's remarks there. I think a lot of lessons have been learned from both sides in the past year, especially from, you know, the call that took place in Doha. Even one of the major, one of the major politicians in Lebanon, Jumblat, openly came out and said
he's the Druze leader.
Very yes, exactly. But it's very important for us to move forward to actually acknowledge the mistakes, if you like, from both sides in the past year. And I think we are definitely going to see a different Lebanon. I think March 14th understands this. And moving forward, I can only see, you know, it just be an excellent, excellent result for everyone.
Well, Haytham Nasser describing his first time voting in Lebanon, 28 years old. Thanks so much for joining us. He's a Lebanese Christian
Thank
who voted for
much.
The March 14th coalition, which won. Amal Saad Goreyev, finally, any suggestion, and some analysts here in the United States have suggested it, that there was an influence on the election by Barack Obama's very symbolic speech from Cairo last week, or is it pretty much irrelevant?
No, that's entirely irrelevant. Barack Obama's speech actually was not received very warmly in Lebanon by any side. People did not get their hopes up before he spoke, and in fact, his speech was widely read by Lebanese media as being high on style and very low on substance. So I would say that had absolutely nothing to do with the election results. If anything, it was mainly vote-buying and expatriate votes which tilted the results in March 14's favor.
All right, Amal Saad Goreyev, an expert on Hezbollah and author of the book Hezbollah, Politics and Religion, suggesting that this election is not a sign of equilibrium, but a presage of possible crisis going forward in Lebanon. Amal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So we are always on at The Takeaway, and we're talking all day about how you decide what it is that you eat. It's not about stopping hunger. It's about morality and medicine and culture and fashion. Danielle from New Jersey writes to us, my French mother always taught me to eat only what makes me strong and healthy. Anything else is wasteful and therefore a sin. Yikes, that was a strict and forceful dictate. In my adolescence, I did eat junk food and got fat. At age 24, my mother's teaching and example kicked in. I became a fan of the organic food movement and have stayed there, raising my family that way ever since. What's your story of how you eat what you eat and why? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
All we've seen so far as compensation rules from Congress, has been a rule that if you receive TARP money, your top 25 executives, none of them can earn a bonus, an oversized bonus that's more than one-third of their base salary. That's it. What has Wall Street done? Wall Street has hiked everyone's base salary, obviously.
How to pay the bailed-out bankers. That's Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
A big fish with a big problem.
Hello. My name is Bruce.
Hello, Bruce.
It has been 3 weeks since my last fish. On my honor, or may I be chopped up and made into soup.
When a big fish in the culinary world decides to sharply curtail eating seafood for moral and environmental reasons, it's a headline above and below the surface of the sea. 12-stepping our pals from the ocean.
Fish are friends, not food.
Finding Nemo? Nope. Finding Mark Bittman on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, June 8th. I do not lie. Mark Bittman's going to be here to explain the morality of eating seafood or not. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, also the secret weapon against global HIV may be in your yogurt. Put down that spoon and we'll explain. Plus, we'll bring you the highlights of Broadway's Tony Awards, all this and more ahead. But first, your top headlines. And in the headlines, the U.S.-backed coalition in Lebanon has beaten Hezbollah. Final results are just in this morning from yesterday's vote. Some analysts had predicted Hezbollah and its allies would win the race. The pro-Western coalition made only small gains from the last vote in 2005. There's a lot going on in North Korea this morning. North Korea's highest court says two American journalists must do 12 years of hard labor. Pyongyang's top court convicted Laura Ling and Yuna Lee of illegal entry and sentenced them today. Bill Richardson negotiated with North Korea as the American ambassador to the UN. He thinks talks for the women's release could begin soon. Also, new signs of a coming missile test. Japan says Pyongyang is telling ships to stay away from its coast. Those are the waters where rocket debris would land. Over the weekend, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said the U.S. is considering putting North Korea back on the list of states that sponsor terrorism. Femi Okeh, what else is new this morning?
Hello there, everybody. President Obama is back in the U.S. and focusing on domestic issues. He's announcing more details on stimulus spending. Today, he'll meet with his cabinet to talk about it. This week also kicks off a renewed White House push on changing healthcare. Searchers are now certain that they've located the wreckage of the Air France Rio to Paris flight. Crews recovered more than a dozen bodies and debris confirmed to be from the plane over the weekend. Now, there's a high-tech international team helping to look for the flight's flight recorders, but it's quite a tough task as the ocean is so deep there. A U.S. Navy team is on the way to join the search. Billy Elliot is the Tony Award winner for Broadway's Best Musical. It took home 10 awards altogether. God of Carnage won for Best Play. And in sports, LA Lakers now have a 2-0 lead over the Orlando Magic in the NBA Finals. Next game tomorrow night in Florida.
First game was a stomp by the Lakers. Second one was won in overtime by the Lakers. Who knows? Maybe Orlando has a chance. Asian stock markets, a mix of positive and negative closings this morning. The S&P starts trading at 940 and the Dow begins at 8763. Futures trading suggests a negative opening on Wall Street in about 30 minutes. So we're talking later with Mark Bittman about how to decide what to eat. Is it just about feeding yourself? Or do you make decisions based on morality or medicine? Do you eat only grass-fed beef, no meat at all? An anti-cancer diet? What fuels the decisions on how you feed yourself? They're complicated stories, and we're betting you have one. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. So North Korea has sentenced two U.S. reporters to 12 years in a forced labor camp. North Korea detained the two journalists, Laura Ling and Yuna Lee, in March, accusing them of crossing the border illegally and conducting undefined hostile acts. This sentence comes as there are more signs that North Korea is planning to test a longer-range missile, and the Obama administration has indicated this weekend that it is seeking a way to interdict, possibly with China's help, North Korean sea and air shipments suspected of carrying weapons or nuclear technology. Here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking over the weekend.
Obviously, we're working closely with our team in New York. We think we're going to come out of this with a very strong resolution, with teeth, that will have consequences for the North Korean regime.
What can the Obama administration or the United Nations, for that matter, as the Secretary of State was referring to there, do about North Korea? It's a challenge for diplomats and also for people who watch the news, sorting out the difference between an international crisis and something of a diplomatic chess game. To help us with all of that is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. David, good morning.
Good morning.
I mean, we could probably have this same conversation last week when we talked extensively about North Korea, but I'm wondering how this sentencing of two U.S. reporters changes the situation, if at all.
Well, you know, you have to hope, John, that they sentenced the two reporters as a prelude to throwing them out of the country. You'll remember the Iranians did that last month with an American reporter who they had sentenced, and they went on for a few days and then expelled her from the country. One never knows, though, if the North Koreans have as refined a sense of their own self-interest here, or whether they might want to use the two reporters as a bargaining chip. Secretary Clinton, in that interview that you referred to, said they really wanted to deal with this separately as a humanitarian issue and not mix it up with the nuclear issue. And I think that's probably the right approach.
But the question is, will the North Koreans allow them to separate these issues out? Diplomats assumed that there would be some test of the Obama administration in the early going, that you would see a ratcheting up of rhetoric and possibly nuclear ambitions, possibly missile tests, that sort of thing. But with the sentencing of these reporters, it appears that a lot is going on simultaneously here. It puts it in really another category than simply a test of a new administration, don't you think?
It sure does. And, you know, it's all wrapped up in the one other piece of news out of North Korea in the past week, which was that it now appears that Kim Jong-il, the very ill dictator of the country, has designated his youngest son, Kim Jong-un, as the likely successor. Kim Jong-un is the 26-year-old who was trained in Switzerland. The CIA gave him the moniker the cute leader because of how he appeared in photos they have hanging up on their desks out there. But the fact of the matter is there's likely a power struggle underway because the military is not so keen on the idea of creating yet a third member of the Kim dynasty. And so all of these events may really be wrapped up in this power struggle.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the rhetoric here. Even though, we're talking about nukes and the sentencing of two young women to 12 years in a forced labor camp, in all cases, it seems as though everyone expects that this is a set of bargaining chips, that this is much more of a chess game than it is some sort of, saber-rattling with unstable consequences. There's all kinds of precedents that when the Koreans or the North Koreans step up the rhetoric, they also back down very, very slowly as long as there are quid pro quos coming their way. What is it that the administration can either do to sanction North Korea at this point or offer them in the form of a carrot to make them come down here?
You know, what I think is the most interesting thing out of this, John, is that in the interviews I've done with members of the administration in the past week, it's become clear that they don't want to offer the kind of carrots that President Bush and before him President Clinton did, because they see the pattern here. The North Koreans create a crisis, then they go and resell you something that they sold the past administration or the administration before that. In those two cases, they sold them the freezing or dismantling of Yongbyon, the major nuclear power plant and reprocessing center where they make their nuclear fuel. And it was very interesting, I thought, last week when the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, said, you know, I don't want to buy that horse again. We've already bought it twice. And so now the administration faces this issue. They want to go to the North Koreans and say, look, you've already agreed to dismantle this stuff. You've already been told by the UN that you can't shoot off any more missiles. We're not going to pay you to do that again. And that means that the only way you could really enforce it is to put the squeeze on them. And that's what the administration is talking about doing with these interdictions at sea and, of course, with financial squeezes as well.
Well, if, as you say, that the Obama policy looks like calling the regime in Pyongyang's bluff on a variety of issues here, the families of Laura Ling and Una Lee probably aren't feeling too comfortable this morning in that they could be caught in this for quite a while.
Absolutely. And, you know, remember when the Pueblo was taken, the American ship that was seized by North Korea
during the Ford administration,
1960s,
right?
It was more than a year before everybody got released.
It was more than a year.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Finally, there is an issue of this interdiction. And at the same time, the North Koreans are trying to indicate that, areas of the sea off their coastline are quarantined in preparation for a missile test. How much of this battle is taking place on the water?
Well, there may be. So far, none has been. In the 2006 UN resolutions after the North's first nuclear test, there was permission given under international law for interdiction of North Korean ships suspected of carrying missiles or nuclear technology. That was never enforced. Right now, the Obama administration faces two ways that you could inspect these ships. One is get the Chinese to do it in their own ports. You know, suddenly they declare a customs inspection because there might be fruit flies, right? And then in the course of that, go in and look at the cargo on the ships. The riskier method is the Cuban Missile Crisis method. It's to stop and board North Korean ships at sea. The risk there, of course, is that the North could, you know, open fire. Then, you know, the U.S. responds.
Well, and it's not an island like Cuba. You know,
it sure is.
There's serious tactical problems. You know, I misspoke when I talked about the Pueblo. That was 1968, as you mentioned, in the 60s. I mean, let's just look at that for a moment. I mean, the 1953 armistice that ended the Korean War has ostensibly been torn up by the regime in Pyongyang. Are we going to possibly see the revisiting of that history in 1968 when, as you say, the crew of the Pueblo was held for more than a year?
You could see some kind of significant confrontations on the water. I don't think they would last very long because the North Korean Navy ain't much. The risk here, of course, is the escalation risk, that you get into one of these confrontations and the North Koreans, in the midst of this power struggle, don't want to appear to be weak in front of the United States.
So they fire something off.
And they fire something off, and then things escalate, and, you know, wars have started over less.
That's for sure.
And so that's the Obama administration's concern here. This is why they'd love the Chinese to go inspect these ships in their ports under national laws, rather than take this kind of bigger risk.
Finally, in your discussions with Obama administration officials, where do they see the greater danger in just stepping back and ignoring North Korea and just saying, we're not going to pay any attention to you anymore, or staying focused on North Korea and running the risk of escalation?
Well, you know, they started with the ignore strategy, and it didn't work. The North Koreans threw the kind of tantrums that you're accustomed to them throwing here. Look, with North Korea, John, I've never been that concerned, and I don't think many in the Obama administration are that concerned, that they're going to lob a nuclear missile at Japan or South Korea or our troops somewhere around there. They're not going to do anything with a return address that would give somebody an excuse to go attack their capital. Instead, the big risk with North Korea has always been a proliferation risk. Remember that reactor that the Israelis blew up in Syria 2 years ago? It was a North Korean-built reactor. You know, the risk here is that they will sell a weapon system or nuclear technology because they have sold everything they've ever made.
And I gather the takeaway here is, does the administration have the capacity now to practice tools and develop tactics that will reduce the risk of that proliferation? I guess that's what the whole interdiction policy is all about. David Sanger, thanks so much for joining us. David Sanger is the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. He joined us from Washington.
Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. I hope you'll stay tuned. Coming up on the program, Mark Bittman, The New York Times food writer, is going to talk about the ethical complications of eating fish. Which prompted this question: what is it that determines the food on your plate? Is it just about stopping hunger? Or do you make decisions based on morality, say medicine, ethics, economics? One listener says eating well can help save money on medical bills.
Most importantly, what we put on our plate affects our health. If people ate organic, whole food, plant-based diet, not only would they be eating more ethically and morally, but would be eating more healthily and happily as well.
There's a story behind what you eat, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. The link between health and food is something that quite literally comes out of the work of Gregor Reed. He joins us now. He's a microbiologist from the Lawson Institute and the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, where he joins us from. Gregor, good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Now, as a microbiologist, you're going to study something that, actually, if you go to the supermarket, you can see on the label, foods like yogurt are not simply uncooked, they're alive, correct?
That's right. In fact, it shouldn't be called yogurt if it didn't have live organisms in it.
There's all kinds of foods that are beyond, raw. They're actually living foods. And you're getting a chance to study yogurt's impact in actually combating HIV. First of all, why are you taking a look at this, and what do you expect to find?
Well, the university has a group of staff and volunteers that were very interested in trying to help the plight of people, particularly in Africa, with HIV/AIDS crisis. And, of course, yogurt is not going to cure AIDS, or we don't really even know the extent to which it helps immunity yet, although we have some suggested research that it does help immunity. But the bottom line is many people don't get access to food and certainly don't get access to antiretroviral therapy. So our idea was, could we provide a nutritious food that helped quality of life in a community that was extremely poor and struck by the HIV/AIDS epidemic?
So this is not a prescription or a suggestion on your part that people who are HIV positive go out and buy 2 gallons of yogurt to eat over the next week. But why is it that a living food, food with living organisms in it, would help or interact with the immune system in a way that could actually improve health?
Well, the organisms, we call them probiotics, but they're essentially lactic acid bacteria. These are beneficial bacteria that have been around for centuries. In fact, it's even quoted in the Bible where they made sour milk. So these are organisms we've used in food for fermentation for a long time. And scientists in the last, I've been doing it for 27 years, but particularly the last 5 years, have shown that these organisms do a lot of things that help us. So, for example, if you have HIV/AIDS in Africa, the chances are you have what we call a leaky gut. And studies have shown, for example, here in Toronto, that if you give these organisms, they essentially help seal the gut so that it doesn't leak as much. The about 90% of HIV/AIDS patients suffer from diarrhea, and these organisms help to alleviate that and in some cases prevent it. So in terms of quality of life, we've shown that fatigue, tiredness, so when you can't eat or when you're not absorbing the food, then you get tired, you don't feel like working. And in Africa, people work every single day because that's how they sustain their life. So it's very interesting. We are studying, and others are studying, the mechanisms where these organisms do, in fact, help the gut. And it's the gut where we're focusing through the food.
And you've got a grant from the World Bank to actually study this. Yet, as you have described, the supposition that living organisms are a help in health in people's food goes back a really long way in history. Why is it that it hasn't been studied and the mechanisms aren't better understood?
It's pretty amazing, really. We would be dead today if we didn't have bacteria inside us. In fact, we have 10 times more bacteria in our gut than we have in total human cells. They just happen to be smaller, obviously. So they're absolutely integral to life and many, many aspects of life. And I think what's happened is it seemed too simple, and we've got so many antibiotics and drugs, and for years and years, people just weren't interested, and it wasn't sort of a sexy scientific area to study, and so people would rather go in and look at, new antibiotics, et cetera.
In a sense, what you're saying is there's more money available to kill germs in food rather than to nurture them.
Oh, absolutely. And you just need to switch on the television in the U.S. and you'll find all kinds of adverts that are aimed at killing bacteria. But it's like killing yourself. Why would we do that? There's some bacteria like Salmonella, clearly, you want to get rid of. But most of our organisms are extremely beneficial and essential for life.
So we really have to change our whole approach to food to understand this better. For instance, instead of, ooh, there's germs on your food, I'm not going to eat that, instead it's just the opposite. No germs on your food? Ugh. That's disgusting.
I'm certainly not saying some of our food can be contaminated. If you eat a raw hamburger, then the chances are you will get sick. But we're talking about we've changed from a human species that ate a lot of plant roots and a lot of fermented food. When I was a kid in Scotland, my mom didn't have a fridge, so we bought fresh food, and we probably ate more fermented food because these organisms are in fermented foods. And so we've gone from that to a lot of two-year shelf life and essentially food with no organisms at all, because we're so paranoid about those that will make us sick. And so we need to have a balance between, yes, let's have the hygiene, it's incredibly important, but also let's have a way to feed our gut with these organisms and foods that help the organisms inside us to grow.
All medicinal qualities that may be a tool in the war on AIDS in Africa and around the world. The World Bank sponsored the work of Gregor Reid, microbiologist from the Lawson Institute and the University of Western Ontario in London, to study the effects of probiotic organisms in foods like yogurt on the spread of AIDS and other diseases. For video and photographs from Gregor Reid's research, you can go to thetakeaway.org. And now, the latest headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. We have some news this morning in the trial of two American journalists held in North Korea. The two women have been sentenced to 12 years of hard labor for illegal entry and committing hostilities against North Korea. Bill Richardson negotiated with North Korea as the American ambassador to the UN. He spoke to the NBC's Today Show.
The North Koreans are raising the stakes. This is a high-stakes poker game.
And the young journalist's sentence cannot be appealed and comes as Washington warned that it might put North Korea back on its list of states that sponsor terrorism, which would further hurt North Korea's economy. The U.S. is sending help in the effort to recover debris from the Air France jet that crashed off the coast of Brazil last week. A Navy team leaves today with devices that can detect emergency beacons, like the flight's black box records 20,000 feet below the surface. And yesterday, rescuers pulled more than a dozen bodies from the crash site. And in sports, the Lakers took the Magic to overtime in L.A. last night to gain a 2-0 lead in the NBA playoff finals. Next game is tomorrow. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. We're talking all day about how you decide what it is that you eat. It's more than just stopping hunger. Your food decisions are all about morality, medicine, culture, fashion even. Well, there is taste. What fuels the decisions on how you feed yourself?
I eat emotionally. I tend to open the cupboard, and depending on how I feel, I pick the food based on how I feel, not what I need nutritionally. When I open the cupboard and understand and accept how I feel, I eat very well. When I open the cupboard angry, lonely, tired, I eat very poorly.
I told you there's a story. There's a story in everybody's decision when they open the cupboard. Tell us yours at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. You know, I'd love to have had for breakfast what Roger Federer had yesterday morning. He won the French Open yesterday, defeating Robin Soderling in straight sets, tying the record of 14 major singles titles held by Pete Sampras. But Sampras, the retired American champion, never won the French Open. It was the only one of the game's four most prestigious tournaments to be played on clay. So is Federer the greatest player ever? Well, the arguments disputing the fact that Federer might just be the greatest tennis player of all time are gradually diminishing. Harvey Eriton joins us, a New York Times sports columnist. Harvey, I mean, it's becoming harder and harder to make the argument that Federer isn't the greatest of all time. What do you make of the victory yesterday?
Well, I think it certainly puts him in the class where, if he's not considered the single greatest player of all time, then perhaps he shares the mantle with Rod Laver, who won only 11 Grand Slams, but went through a 5-year period as a professional where he was barred from playing in the Grand Slams in the so-called amateur era.
Right.
And also won as an amateur and a professional several years apart, all the tournaments in a calendar year. But Federer now is obviously elevating himself to a point where, you know, he's won 14. He's tied Sampras, and Sampras is pretty much out of the discussion because he never even made the finals in Paris.
Right.
Roger has obviously won 3 times in Australia, 5 times at Wimbledon, 5 times at the U.S. Open, and now the French. So, and he's only 27 years old. I think he turns 28 this summer. So,
we're
talking about a guy who has a chance to, you know, pile on some more and then, you know, end the discussion once and for all.
Well, Harvey, you know, the interesting statistic to me was yesterday Federer became only the 6th man to win the singles title at all of the Grand Slam tournaments. I mean, you sort of suggested that. But here are the others. There's Andre Agassi, Rod Laver, Roy Emerson, Fred Perry, and Don Budge. How different players are those, or are they all with a good argument for being fabulous all-around tennis players as opposed to specific, you know, sort of standouts?
Well, again, you know, it's difficult to compare era to era. Some of these players, actually all of them with the exception of Andre Agassi, when they won career slams, they won on clay in Paris, they won on grass at Wimbledon, but back in the days when there were days when the U.S. Open was on grass and also the Australian Open was on grass. So I think in the modern era, you're going to have to give some points to the players like Federer and Agassi for winning on hard courts in the U.S. Open and in Australia and grass and clay. Now, another guy to throw into this is, of course, Rafael Nadal, who has already won the French Open, obviously, and has won at Wimbledon and has won at Australia. So he's won on all different surfaces. He has not completed the career slam because he has yet to win the U.S. Open. And he's now dealing with some problems with his knee. And most people who are, you know, the experts in tennis have expected if Nadal will be derailed as from elevating himself into the category of the greatest among the greatest players, it will be because of the stress on his body. He's a very muscular player, and he really is a grinder of a player. And there's a feeling that his body might break down if he moves into his mid to later 20s.
Well, as entertaining as it is to watch Nadal play, he is a streaky kind of player, and a lot of the tennis players do have these streaks where they're hot and not. Federer, it seems to me, is robot-like in that even on a bad day, he has an incredible capacity to bring his play to a competitive level.
Well, Roger's perhaps the most impressive aspect of his run is that he's reached a Grand Slam semifinal in 20 straight tournaments. And, you know, when you think about that, from year to year, avoiding, he's never lost to a player outside the top 5 in a Grand Slam.
That's amazing.
During this run. And so he's avoided all upsets. He's obviously had Nadal not come along at sort of a precocious and well-developed LeBron James-like teenager in terms of his physical stature. Roger, you know, would have already rocketed past 14 and would have won the French Open. I think, you know, there's a sort of a distortion. There was a sort of a distortion at work with Roger and the French Open up until yesterday, or until this year, where he seemed, you know, it seemed to people he was kind of feeble on the clay because he'd get to the final or three straight finals and then the year before that, the semifinals, and lose to Nadal. And last year, of course, he was completely demolished in the final. But the man has reached four straight French Open finals. And again, you know, you realize the degree of difficulty. He's been dominant at Wimbledon. He's been dominant at the U.S. Open on the hard courts. And he's now made four straight French Open finals and finally won it. So, yeah, I mean, he's a gifted player. And I think the best thing for Roger is that in this particular French Open, he really, again, showed a lot of fight.
It's that emotional dimension that really tells the tale, and he kind of blew away the asterisk on his resume by winning that French Open. Harvey Ereton, thanks so much for joining us. He's a sports columnist for our partners, the New York Times, talking to us about Federer tying Pete Sampras's record of 14 Grand Slam wins yesterday after winning the French Open. And Femi Oke has the headlines.
Thank you very much. Have a lot of news coming in this morning from the Middle East. The parliamentary election results in Lebanon are now official. The US-backed coalition led by Saad Hariri won over the opposition alliance headed by Hezbollah. Speaking on Lebanese television, Hariri thanked President Obama for his support and said he hoped to better the relationships between Lebanon and the US. In Baghdad today, a bomb has torn through a minibus during morning rush hour, killing at least 9 people and wounding 24. The blast struck a Shiite enclave in a mainly Sunni neighborhood, and it hit just 3 weeks before the deadline for US troops to withdraw from urban areas of Iraq. And 4 American contractors and 1 Iraqi have been detained in Baghdad in connection with the stabbing death of another American contractor. Now, that news comes according to the Iraqi government. It was earlier reported that all of the contractors held were American. Now, if the case goes to court, the 4 men will be the first Americans tried under Iraqi law. Let's look at top stories making headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Well, last night it was the Tony Awards here in New York honoring the best of Broadway. Joining us to take a look at the winners, the losers, and all of the stage craft we should be paying attention to is Jesse Green, who reports on culture for New York Magazine. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning, John.
So I'm going to play a little game with you here. We got 4 songs from the Tony-nominated musicals, and as they're playing, I want you to guess them, all right, or identify them. I'm sure that you can. Here we go.
Billy Elliot.
There you go.
This is from the new partly Spanish version of West Side Story.
Very good.
This is Next to Normal.
And finally, here's the easy one.
And that's Hair.
So it's kind of back to the future at the Tonys last night. 3 of those are, well, certainly 2 of those are you know, revivals, I guess, done in a very, very different way. The winner, of course, Billy Elliot. What does that say?
Well, actually, Billy Elliot won all the categories it was expected to win, and it's a great show, and it was sort of a juggernaut, terribly successful at the box office also. But what's interesting to note, really, is that a lot of shows, both musicals and dramas, shared the wealth of the Tonys last night, as if people were just glad that shows were running in these economic times.
You know, what shows are likely to benefit from the Tonys? We've seen the Tonys morph from a end-of-the-season award ceremony to something that really almost kicks off the season in the sense that Tony Awards give shows momentum for box office later on in the year.
Certainly for musicals, but of the musicals that won in major categories, Billy Elliot, Next to Normal, Hair, and West Side Story, 3 of them are already certified huge hits, and this will just allow them to continue to be so well into the rest of the year and into next year, probably. The show that's most likely to gain something from this that it might not otherwise have gotten is the newcomer and the difficult show, Next to Normal, which, as you may know, is a tough musical about a woman who is bipolar and the effect that has on her family. So it's not necessarily the first thing tourists might come to see, unless they have a personal link to the story. But with the imprimatur of the Tony Award, maybe they'll give it another chance.
And I'm noticing in the marketing they're not saying Broadway's bipolar musical when they talk about The Next to Normal. What about the stage plays?
In the case of the stage plays, the Tony Award's value is less known, and a lot of them are limited runs in any case. But they'll all pick up at the box office, not perhaps by as much as Joe Turner's Come and Gone picked up at the box office as a result of the visit last week by the Obamas. But they all ought to do well because of it. And one of the shows, the one that's already a gigantic hit, God of Carnage, may well choose to continue even after its major stars leave. They may get enough of a kick that they can put in a new cast and continue to run.
Quickly, why is God of Carnage a hit?
Well, it's an interesting question, John, because it doesn't on the surface read like a hit. It's a very dire sort of comedy about two families who get together to discuss a fight that was had between the sons of each family in a schoolyard. And then, of course, the parents start to behave worse than their kids.
Down definitely sells. I mean, August Osage County did really, really well, and that is about as depressing as you can get. Unfortunately, we got to go, but Jesse, that's great stuff. Jesse Green reports on culture for New York Magazine. Happy Tonys.
Bye-bye.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. In just a moment, New York Times food writer Mark Bittman will tell us the story of why he's not eating as much fish as he used to. And we're betting there's a story as to why you eat certain foods and avoid others.
Hi, this is Claire Unabia from Brooklyn and formerly of America's Next Top Model. I try to eat the most sustainable possible, and it's gotten me on a path. First of all, I'm not eating meat, and then now I'm down to eating raw foods, which also feels the most healthy for me and the most pure.
What's your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org? And now headlines with Femi Okay.
Thank you very much, John. North Korea's highest court says that two American journalists must do 12 years of hard labor. Pyongyang's top court convicted Laura Ling and Una Lee of illegal entry and sentenced them today. Bill Richardson negotiated with North Korea as the American ambassador to the United Nations. He tells NBC that he's hopeful that the women can eventually come home.
The good news, I believe, is that now diplomacy and negotiation for the humanitarian release can begin.
There are also some new signs of a coming missile test. Japan says that Pyongyang is telling ships to stay away from its coastline. President Obama is back on American soil after last week's trip to the Middle East and Europe. He's focusing on domestic issues, such as announcing more detail on stimulus spending. And today he will meet with his cabinet to talk about money. China's government plays a rather large role in healthcare, and New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin is getting a taste of the aggressive approach this morning. Authorities have him and his wife quarantined in Shanghai, and the lockdown came after a passenger on his flight showed possible symptoms of H1N1 or swine flu. Nagin is there on a trade mission. His office says the couple has no symptoms and that Chinese officials are treating them courteously. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. So what's on your plate? Are you eating what's on your plate? And what's the story behind what it is that you eat?
Hi, this is Kate from Rhode Island. I try to eat things that are mostly plant-based. When I do eat meat, I try to make it of high quality. It's very much of a Mark Bittman type of philosophy. Now, why I drink what I drink, that's another story.
Hey, wait a minute. I'm interested in this idea of a Mark Bittman philosophy, sort of. New York Times food writer Mark Bittman is here with us in the studio to talk about his
and thereby our relationship with the creatures of the sea. Mark, first of all, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
I love this Mark Bittman sort of philosophy.
I wish I knew what it was.
Well, it relates to fish this morning. Explain, this is a huge decision for you to change your relationship with fish that goes really back to the beginnings of your career.
Yeah, the first book I wrote about and the first series of articles I wrote was about fish. And my philosophy, if there was one at that point, was see it, buy it, eat it. And I thought, you know, this is great. There are these hundreds of different creatures out there. They're all different. They're really interesting. I have a very, I guess, eclectic Catholic palate. I enjoyed everything, and I just thought this is fabulous. I had tutors, I had gurus, I bought every fish I saw, and well, as much as I could eat, and I learned how to cook and eat them, and really, really enjoyed myself.
There is a challenge to cooking fish, which you've discovered and explored throughout your career, but there's also a moral challenge of consuming fish, which has become clear to you much more recently. Explain how your sort of moral compass changed how you taste something like Chilean sea bass.
Well, you know, I would say that just to touch on the first thing you said, the cooking part is really easy, and that's I think that probably helped me a lot early in my career because I didn't know how to cook that well. The moral part is becoming increasingly difficult, and starting at the end of World War II, but certainly at an accelerating rate through the 70s and 80s. We saw three increasing trends. One was the catching of fish by what effectively are factory fishing vessels. So huge trawlers, lines that are now so big that they could go 500 times around the earth, et cetera, et cetera. So this decimated a lot of fish stocks. We saw also the international trade in fish, so that instead of eating fish, which was local, and when we all sort of knew, you know, if you lived in New York, you knew you were going to see clams and flounder and porgy and squid and maybe tuna, but it was all sort of Long Islandish, Cape Codish, New Jersey-ish. We'd started to see things from New Zealand. And then the third thing was aquaculture, which was heralded at first, but has shown to have a lot of problems.
So technological developments like refrigeration, which accounts for the export of fish from all over the world, and this sort of industrial technology that allows the massive industrial harvesting of fish, and aquaculture, all technological changes have decimated the taste and numbers of all kinds of species?
Taste, not so much. Of course, if you think that big fish taste better than little fish, which sometimes they do, yes, because there aren't as many big fish as there used to be. In fact, some people say 90% of our really big fish are gone. But numbers, you know, absolutely. I mean, probably half the fish in the world are endangered in one way or another.
Well, what I wanted to do is give listeners a real tangible sense of how you evaluate fish as Mark Bittman, with your Mark Bittman sort of philosophy, species by species. Now, here is a farm-raised salmon. Okay, you see this fish, looks gorgeous, but what's the cautionary tale behind it?
Well, farm-raised salmon, I thought, you know, we all thought, in a way, farm-raised salmon brought salmon to a much larger audience because before that, the Alaskan catch was mostly canned and it was seasonal anyway, and it was heralded as the dawn of a new age. This was aquaculture at its best, but it has been shown to be seriously polluting in the environments in which it's grown. It's often laden with antibiotics. There are some worries about whether escapees breed with wild fish and therefore degrade the quality of the wild fish or degrade their ability to survive in the wild.
It's a biodiversity question. Yeah.
And maybe that's enough reasons.
Well, what about Chilean sea bass? Looks delicious here on the plate.
Actually called Patagonian toothfish, Chilean sea bass was another of the many substitutes for cod, which itself was endangered long ago. And, you know, it tastes really good. But anytime the big marketers say, oh, here's a fish we can sell, and it starts to get sold in big numbers, it becomes endangered. And Chilean sea bass is actually coming off the endangered species list. But had a few very rough years there where the catch had to be limited.
So farm-raised shrimp, come on, this has to be benign. You're
that's exactly the problem. It's benign. It doesn't taste like anything. In fact, farm-raising shrimp has gotten much better. There are fewer antibiotics. It's being done in a better manner. They have to figure out how to make it taste like something. It's simply not worth eating.
Now, this is a sort of a Holocaust-looking picture of bluefin tuna there at the harvest, all laid out.
Japan, no doubt. Well, yeah. This is... You know, bluefin tuna is arguably one of the best eating fish in the world, but it is seriously endangered. And really, if I had to say one thing, I would say don't eat it.
Don't eat bluefin.
Do not. Not until things change.
Tilapia? Come on. I can at least keep my tilapia.
Well, tilapia, you know, tilapia is getting better, but again, it's just, you can keep it. It's fine, but you better add a lot of flavor to it if you're cooking it, because there's none in there.
Now, how much of this is an agonized personal decision, and how much of it is a, you know, Mark Bittman's going to get a lot of attention if he swears off fish?
Well, I'm not doing it to get attention, and I don't even pretend to have the answers here. It's entirely an agonized personal decision because... Well, it's not that agonized. It's very clear to me this is the way that we have to go. You can't eat other species if you're going to decimate them. I mean, there's arguments to be made that you can't eat them at all. Having bypassed those arguments, I would like to say, to me, if you want to eat bluefin tuna, you have to hold back for a few years, and maybe it'll come back to sustainable numbers again. It's not that difficult, and it's not that... complex.
The moral dimension of consumption of seafood. Mark Bittman, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
That's New York Times food writer Mark Bittman. His very first cookbook was called Fish, The Complete Guide to Buying and Cooking Fish. So all over the web, we've got pictures of the species he was talking about and also some special web-only questions that we asked Mark Bittman. We've been talking today about how you decide what to eat. What is the story that fuels your decision?
Hi, my name is Jada, and I'm from New York. I'm just calling to say that I don't think it's at all like you're describing about morality and ethics and whatnot. Why? I think it is, but secondarily, I think primarily, it's about class. I mean, it's all very well and good for us to sit here and say, discuss the morality of food, but the fact is that we can't afford to buy the more ethically inclined food, then it's not even really an option, is it?
Tell us your take. Class warfare on your plate, 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway. It's also about food.
We need to have a balance between, yes, let's have the hygiene. It's incredibly important. But also, let's have a way to feed our gut with these organisms and foods that help the organisms inside us to grow.
Gregor Reed, microbiologist from the Lawson Institute in the University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario, studying how probiotics in yogurt, living creatures in yogurt, could slow the spread of AIDS. If you missed any of our food-related content, it's always there at thetakeaway.org. You can subscribe to our podcast there or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. Eat up, won't you? This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.